I'm Jay Hughes, producer of Change Surfer Radio, and for the next half hour, I'll be your guide to a sexy high-tech vision of a radically democratic future, brought to you by the Institute for Ethics and Emerging Technologies. Welcome to Change Surfer Radio.
Hey there, Change Surfers. It's Dr. J back in the seat again. I was on a meditation retreat, and before that I was in Chicago speaking at a science fiction convention, a very small anarchist science fiction convention. And before that I was in Washington, D.C. with my kid doing the Castro documentary thing at National History Day. And now I'm back in the seat again here in Storrs, Connecticut, bucolic. And finally, sunny Storrs, Connecticut. The meditation retreat went well. I was on staff for the first time at the Insight Meditation Society's family retreat and working with a group of 10, 11, and 12, and 13-year-olds. We put on a play. I had a good time, and I reflected a lot at this retreat on the motivations for why I say things. I tend to be a pretty jokey kind of person, and I'm often teasing people. And this kind of a retreat where you're meditating part of the time and then trying to talk to people in a generally kind and mindful way is a good opportunity to watch the motivations of your speech. And so I was struck by this piece from the New York Times last week called Why the Imp in Your Brain Gets Out. It's by Benedict Carey. I want to read just a little bit of this because I think it's fascinating. The visions seem to swirl up from the brain's sewage system at the worst possible times, during a job interview, a meeting with the boss, an apprehensive first date, an important dinner party. What if I started a food fight with these hors d'oeuvres, mocked the host's stammer, cut loose with a racial slur? That single thought is enough, wrote Edgar Allan Poe in The Imp of the Perverse, an essay on unwanted impulses. The impulse increases to a wish, the wish to a desire, the desire to an uncontrollable longing. He added, there is no passion in nature so demonically impatient as that of him who, shuddering upon the edge of a precipice, thus meditates a plunge, or meditates on the question, am I sick? In a few cases, the answer may be yes, but a vast majority of people rarely, if ever, act on such urges, and their susceptibility to rude fantasies, in fact, reflects the workings of a normally sensitive social brain, argues a paper published last week in the journal Science. There are all kinds of pitfalls in social life everywhere we look, not just errors, but worst possible errors come to mind, and they come to mind easily, said the paper's author, Daniel Wegner, a psychologist at Harvard. And having the worst thing come to mind in some circumstances might increase the likelihood that it will happen. The exploration of perverse urges has a rich history. How could it not? Running through the stories of Poe and Marquis de Sade, to Freud's repressed desires, and Darwin's observation that many actions are performed in direct opposition to our conscious will. In the past decade, social psychologists have documented how common such contrary urges are and when they are most likely to alter people's behavior. At a fundamental level, functioning socially means mastering one's impulses. The adult brain expends at least as much energy on inhibition as on action, some studies suggest, and mental health relies on abiding strategies to ignore or suppress deeply disturbing thoughts of one's own inevitable death, for example. These strategies are general, subconscious, or semi-conscious psychological programs that usually run on autopilot. Perverse impulses seem to arise when people focus intensely on avoiding specific errors or taboos. The theory is straightforward. To avoid blurting out that a colleague is a raging hypocrite, the brain must first imagine just that. The very presence of that catastrophic insult, in turn, increases the odds that the brain will spit it out. We know that what's accessible in our minds can exert an influence on judgment and behavior simply because it's there. It's floating on the surface of consciousness, says Jamie Arndt, a psychologist at the University of Missouri. The empirical evidence of this influence has been piling up in recent years, as Dr. Wegner documents in a new paper. In the lab, psychologists have people try to banish a thought from their minds, of a white bear, for example, and find that the thought keeps returning about once a minute. Likewise, people trying not to think of a specific word continually blurted out during rapid-fire word association tests. The same ironic errors, as Dr. Wegner calls them, are just easy to evoke in the real world. Golfers instructed to avoid a specific mistake like overshooting do it more often when under pressure, studies find. Soccer players told to shoot a penalty kick anywhere but at a certain spot of the net, like the lower right corner, look at that spot more often than any other. Efforts to be politically correct can be particularly treacherous. In one study, researchers at Northwestern and Lehigh Universities had 73 students read a vignette about a fictional peer, Donald, a black male. The students saw a picture of him and read a narrative about his visit to a mall with a friend. In the crowded parking lot, Donald would not park in a handicapped space, even though he was driving his grandmother's car, which had a pass, but he did butt in front of another driver to snag a non-handicapped space. He snubbed a person collecting money for a heart fund while his friend contributed some change, and so on. The story purposely portrayed the protagonist in an ambiguous way. The researchers had about half the students try to suppress bad stereotypes of black males as they read, and later judged Donald's character on measures like honesty, hostility, and laziness. These students rated Donald as significantly more hostile, but also more honest, than did students who were not trying to suppress stereotypes. In short, the attempt to banish biased thoughts worked to some extent, but the study also provided a strong demonstration that stereotype suppression leads stereotypes to become hyper-accessible, the authors concluded. Because basically, when you tell people not to think about the stereotypes, they think about the stereotypes. Smokers, heavy drinkers, and other habitual substance users know this confusion too well. The effort to squelch a longing for a smoke or a drink can bring to mind all the reasons to break the habit. At the same time, the desire seemingly gets stronger. The risk that people will slip or lose it depends in part on the level of stress they are undergoing, Dr. Wegner argues. Concentrating intensely on not staring at a prominent mole on a new acquaintance's face while also texting and trying to follow a conversation heightens the risk of saying, "We went to the mole, I mean the mall, the mall." A certain relief came from just getting it over with, having that worst thing happen so you don't have to worry about monitoring it anymore, said Dr. Wegner. All of which might be hard to explain, of course, if you've just mooned the dinner party. And I find this very relieving because although I was not under a great deal of stress at the time, I did say something incredibly embarrassing at this meditation retreat and a highly politically inappropriate comment. And I've been kicking myself and just having general heart palpitations about what kind of negative, vile stuff must be bubbling under the surface of my unconscious. So hopefully this is just an example of the fact that when you think about all the bad things that you could say, they pop up. Now, a related piece of news, also from Harvard, neuroimaging studies suggest that truthfulness requires no act of will for honest people. Dishonesty involves activity in control-related brain networks. A new study of the cognitive processes involved with honesty suggests that truthfulness depends more on absence of temptation than active resistance to temptation. Using neuroimaging, psychologists looked at the brain activity of people given the chance to gain money dishonestly by lying and found that honest people showed no additional neural activity when telling the truth, implying that extra cognitive processes were not necessary to choose honesty. However, those individuals who behaved dishonestly, even when telling the truth, showed additional activity, showed additional activity in brain regions that involve control and attention. The study is published in Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences and was led by Joshua Green, an assistant professor at the Faculty of Arts and Sciences at Harvard. Being honest is not so much a matter of exercising willpower as it is of being disposed to behave honestly in a more effortless kind of way. This may not be true for all situations, but it seems to be true for at least this situation. The research was designed to test two theories about the nature of honesty: the will theory, in which honesty results from the act of resistance of temptation, and the grace theory, in which honesty is a product of lack of temptation. The results of this study suggest that the grace theory is true because the honest participants did not show any additional neural activity when telling the truth. They didn't have to think about what they were going to say. They just said what was true, whereas to actually lie required an effort. To prompt participants to lie, The researchers created a cover story about the focus of their study. The research was presented as a study of paranormal ability to predict the future. Participants were asked to predict the outcomes of a series of coin tosses and were told that the researchers believed predicting the future was more likely when given a monetary incentive and when the prediction wasn't shared in advance of the outcome. This gave the participants the opportunity to lie and say that they had correctly predicted the coin toss to win the money. The researchers assessed the honesty of the individuals based on whether their number of correct responses was statistically feasible. Individuals who reported improbably high levels of accuracy were classified as dishonest, and participants reporting statistically feasible levels of accuracy were classified as honest. Now, of course, rereading this, I'm noticing that if you believe that there was actually psychic activity involved, the ones who were actually having high levels of accuracy and were being measured as having high levels of brain activity, maybe that brain activity was their psychic ability. But since I don't believe in psychic ability either, I'm much more prone to accept Harvard researchers' conclusions here that the brain activity is related to lying as opposed to the potential psychic ability. Okay. Using fMRI, Green found that the honest individuals displayed little to no additional brain activity when reporting their prediction of the coin toss, honest meaning aka almost random. However, the dishonest participants, aka the almost reportedly accurate ones, were the most active in control-related brain regions when they chose not to lie. These control-related brain regions include the dorsolateral prefrontal cortex and the anterior cingulate cortex, which I've probably said those two parts of the brain many times on this show, and I still have no idea where they are, but at any rate, for those of you who do. And the previous research has shown that these regions are active when an individual is asked to lie. Okay, so that's great stuff. That's reported in Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences, and you can find it there, Joshua Green. Now, I'm starting to teach a second summer course, my first summer course, the first summer course at Trinity that I've ever taught. In the second session of the summer, I'm starting on Monday. And so those of you who are curious, you can contact me. I haven't taught a straight bioethics course in quite a while, and I'm pulling together a number of resources about what to teach about, one of which is this short little piece about questions that the Supreme Court may face in the future. It's written under the hook of the Sotomayor confirmation hearings. And it's written here by Alan Maurer, who's a futurist and tech consultant. So this was published in techjournalsouth.com. A Supreme Court justice often sits on the bench for a quarter of a century and in the next 25 years may face questions about the rights of future generations, how private is our personal genetic profile, and at what point does artificial intelligence become human? So says futurist Josh Calder with DC-based Social Technologies. Here's a set of 8 questions. Okay, so the futurist is Josh Calder, the author of the piece. The journalist is Alan Maurer. Here's a set of 8 questions Calder says senators probably will not ask Sotomayor about, although she could encounter them in coming decades. 1. Think of the children. Do future generations have rights? Are we actually obligated to take them into account in environmental and technological decisions? The idea of future generations having rights is an emerging one that speaks to issues of sustainability. It comes up directly in genetics. Part of it has to do with the idea of using technology to make deeper impacts on ourselves and the future. 2. R2D2 2. 2 R2D2 2. Will an advanced artificial intelligence arise as people like Ray Kurzweil predict, and will it merit rights? And I think an additional question is, will it merit immediate termination because of its danger to human beings? But those are separate questions. People have been talking about the possibility of a singularity in which artificial intelligence becomes sentient in a couple of decades, says Calder. It involves 2 questions. If something says it's sentient, do we believe it? And if so, do we care? It may be more of a question if it involves a biological system. Does something require a biological brain to be human? Well, not human. Human isn't the point. As far as I'm concerned, person or rights-bearing being is more the point, because human is not coincident or equivalent to rights-bearing being. But anyway, 3, virtually real. How real are virtual goods, places, and avatars? Will virtual property take on any kind of legal existence beyond its current status of code that is owned by provider companies? What is driving this is people growing more attached to virtual property and goods, says Calder. Do you own your own virtual property, really? What if they shut the whole world down? Another way this is going to blur is with rapid prototyping devices. Now, people may think that this just has to do with 3D virtual reality, by the way. But what if you're on Facebook and all of your photos and all of your contacts and all the information you put into Facebook suddenly disappears, or the Facebook folks suddenly declare that it's their property and not yours? So the virtual property question is out there. It may be increasingly possible to take property from the virtual world to the real world and vice versa. 4, the truth in your brain. Is brain scanned lie detector evidence admissible as court testimony? What can scanning of memory tell us? This also brings up the question of false memories and how to distinguish them from real ones, Calder says. Exactly. Because if we can't, then we've got a problem. 5, genetic secrets. Do people have genetic privacy? When gene sequencing is easy and cheap, will the information still be closely held secret? That is, if you can just take someone's cup or a little bit of their hair from their brush or their toothbrush or whatever, and get their entire gene sequence from that, will that be considered breaking the law? I mean, it's almost like saying, if the technology gets good enough and fast enough and cheap enough in the future, it's like saying looking at someone might be breaking the law because you've taken an image of them into your eyes, or taking a picture of someone might be breaking the law, because it might be that easy, just taking a picture of someone with gene sequencing. It also brings up the issue of brain scanning to tell what someone is thinking. Is it reliable? If so, to what purposes will it be used? If it's found it can prevent terrorism, we could have more and more invasive means of scanning and IDing permitted. On the other hand, if insurance companies tried to require genetic sequencing to determine a person's genetic susceptibility to diseases or pre-existing conditions, the industry would collapse, says Calder. It's not going to happen, he predicts. Well, there's already the gene privacy legislation out there. So that was passed a couple years ago, which protects people from being obliged by their employers, for instance, to have to divulge their genetic information. But the point here is that if insurance companies, health insurance companies, want to know have a fully predictive model for each person about how much disease they're going to suffer and how much that insurance company is going to have to pay out for them, and then is not required, as they hopefully will be shortly by health reform legislation, is not required to charge everybody the same. That is, if I get to charge you exactly what you're going to cost me as an insurance company because of your gene sequence, then the whole idea of pooled risk would collapse. Now, the health reforms that are coming through probably are going to get rid of that possibility. Health insurance companies are probably going to be required very shortly now to charge everybody the same. So hopefully that won't be a case. 6, better humans. How far may we go in enhancing ourselves with pharmaceuticals, information implants, and genetic engineering? And what enhancements can parents choose for their children? And those, of course, are very central questions for Change Surfer Radio and for the Institute for Ethics and Emerging Technologies, as are all these questions. 7, guilty genes. Are there any genetic characteristics that so greatly increase the chance of criminality that they justify preventive action? What if we discovered that 70% of sociopathic murderers had a particular genetic combination, says Calder? Do we screen juvenile offenders for this? I think that's a very interesting question. I think, because we predictive modeling for crime and for terrorism, I think, has a very strong rationale, but it also can violate legal principles that you have to be guilty to before you can be subject to the law. You have to have committed a crime before you're subject to the law. 8, a horse is a horse. With animals now being given human genes, will we cross a line in which an animal becomes more than a human, and in which an animal becomes more than an animal? Chances are slim any senators will address any of these questions, although it may be better off if they did. So that last question is the line between human and animal and whether, in fact, genes have anything to do with it, as Jeremy Rifkin and Stuart Newman tried to do a number of years ago when they tried to patent a hypothetical humanzy or half chimp, half human, and tried to get the U.S. Patent Office to say that, to draw a line and say this much human genome is required, once you have this much human genome, you can't patent it because you can't patent human beings because that would be slavery and blah, blah, blah. Of course, 20% of our genome is already patented, and patenting a whole organism is the only question there, whether you'd be able to patent a different version of a human embryo or a human phenotype. Hopefully that won't be the case. But the reason that we shouldn't be able to patent humans and that you might want to be able to patent, a cancer mouse, an onco mouse, a mouse intended for cancer research, is because humans have certain cognitive characteristics that the onco mouse doesn't. So it's the cognitive characteristics that are really important in this legal question. I do hope that they address that, but I certainly hope that they don't address it in terms of genes, because genes would be a totally irrelevant characteristic. The genetic difference between humans and non-humans would be totally irrelevant to the question. So anyway, Calder has been a professional futurist since 1995 and is social technologies thought leader. He's also creator of futuristmovies.com, a site that examines the future as depicted in movies, and has written for Wired magazine and can be found at socialtechnologies.com. Okay, a couple quick facts reported at scienceprogress.org, one of our favorite sites at the IAT, the science policy project of the Center for American Progress. And the title here is, surveys show that Americans respect scientists, but a gap persists on perceptions of climate change, and the public supports actions to curb emissions. So this is a report on Pew Research. We love Pew Research, good social science research. Pew Research Center for the People and the Press at the American Association of the Advancement of Science. So here are some of the facts. 70% of Americans believe that scientists contribute a lot to the well-being of society. Good. 60% of Americans believe the proportion of the public who agrees that government investment in research is essential for scientific progress. So 40% weren't so sure. That's a little troubling. Government investment in research is essential. I guess there might be some libertarians out there and others who just don't know whether government investment is doing anything in scientific progress. 40% is the proportion of the public who would increase scientific research funding if given the opportunity to shape the federal budget. So 60% think it helps. 20% fewer than that would increase and the amount of federal budget going towards scientific research. 67% is the proportion of Americans who support increased federal spending on science education. Okay, so 2/3 of Americans believe that science education is an important federal priority and would increase the amount of federal funding for science education. Only 60%, so somewhat fewer number, believe that government investment is important for scientific progress. So a little bit of cognitive dissonance there for some. And only 40% think that we should increase science research funding. So the many more want to, if you add education onto it, many more want to increase funding for that. Obviously, they're looking at their 12-year-olds and realizing that they're not terribly interested in science and think that if we poured more money into science education, then little Johnny could grow up to discover the cure for cancer. Okay, 50% is the proportion of the general public that says the Earth is getting warmer, mostly because of human activity such as burning fossil fuels. Actually, it's 49%. So that's fail. That's climate change realism fail. The proportion of the general public that says the Earth is getting warmer because of human activity. So a lot of the public out there under the impression that it's demons or, it's just a big socialist green conspiracy to have fuel emission standards on their SUVs or whatever. Okay, anyway, 84% the proportion of scientists who attribute the Earth's warming to human activity. So 84% of scientists believe this, only 49% of Americans in general believe in anthropogenic climate change. 56% is the proportion of the public who believe that scientists generally agree that human activity contributes to Earth's warming. So half of Americans don't believe in climate change or anthropogenic climate change. And only a little bit more than half of Americans believe that most scientists believe in anthropogenic climate change. So they are ignorant of the scientific consensus, which is illustrated by the 84% of scientists who actually do believe in anthropogenic climate change. 70%, the proportion of scientists who consider global warming a very serious problem. That's interesting. So 84% believe in anthropogenic climate change, but a smaller percentage believe it's a very serious problem. So obviously some are techno-optimists about our ability to solve these problems or see bigger problems out there than even anthropogenic climate change and are gauging the seriousness relative to those other problems. I certainly agree there are many other serious problems out there. And 47% is the proportion of Americans who consider global warming a very serious problem. So 47% of Americans compared to 70% of scientists. But the American public does support substantial action to tackle climate change, according to the recent ABC Washington Post poll. 75% support government regulation of greenhouse gases. 52% support a system of cap and trade, although what percentage of Americans actually understand the cap and trade, I don't have any idea, but 60% of Americans support U.S. action on climate change, even if other nations take less substantial steps. So majorities of Americans support strong action on climate change, even though they may be dubious about the origins of climate change. So anyway, a little bit of good news, a little bit of bad news. This has been Dr. J with Change Surfer Radio. Hang loose out there, and I hope that you have a lovely, lovely summer, at least if you're on my side of the planet where we are experiencing summer. You've been listening to Change Surfer Radio, a sexy high-tech vision of a radically democratic future brought to you by the Institute for Ethics and Emerging Technologies and produced at WHUS Stores at the University of Connecticut. I'm Jay Hughes, the host and producer of Change Surfer Radio and executive director of the IET. If you want to learn more about the techno-progressive perspective of Change Surfer Radio and the IET, or you want to share your thoughts about our programs, email me at director@ieet.org. You can find the Institute for Ethics and Emerging Technologies at ieet.org. You can subscribe to a weekly podcast of Change Surfer Radio and listen to or download all of our shows since 1998, thanks to archive.org. So educate, agitate, and organize, and I hope to meet you in a sexy, high-tech, and yet radically democratic future.